Did you ever think that Mona Lisa, the woman in the picture, was just blocking the view?
The way that everybody has done that painting, I just felt, my God, you know, what more could we do with the Mona Lisa except take her out?
Today in Studio 360, we're taking in the scenery, looking a little more closely at all the different kinds of backgrounds essential to paintings, movies, and music.
The rhythm side of the bass is related to the drums. We are like the mother and the father of a family. The bass and the drums. We have to work together. We have to play off of each other, and we have to listen to each other.
All that's ahead, plus a visit with the singer-songwriter Amy Mann.
I think music is so interesting because it completely creates this emotional subtext that's ready-made, and then you have the story on top of it.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me in Studio 360 right after this.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From WNYC in New York and Public Radio International, I'm Kurt Anderson. The shadowy power of the background, it's a hallmark of radio especially. Because of the sound, you know where I am or what I'm feeling or what you're supposed to be feeling. Each scene is set in your mind without me saying a word. Today in Studio 360, we're focusing on the background, that space in the distance that ends up doing a lot of heavy lifting in music, in paintings, and in the movies. Rachel Portman is my guest today. She's composed music for dozens of films, including The Cider House Rules, Chocolat, The Joy Luck Club, and the recent Manchurian Candidate. Her score for Emma won her an Oscar. Right now, you're hearing her music for Roman Polanski's Oliver Twist, which opens at the end of the month. Rachel Portman, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So you've scored dozens of films, as I said before. If you can take me through that process a little bit, how does it work?
Well, first of all, if I jump to the part where I've been asked to write the score, so I've been invited to write the score, then I would receive a copy of it on DVD or whatever, and I would watch it several times. And when I felt I really know the film quite well, then I would go and have a meeting, in this case with Roman, and we'd talk about where he thinks there should be music, and I'd come prepared with where I think there should be music.
And were those ideas that you shared instantly, or not necessarily?
By and large, they were, but not all. It proved to be a very hard film to get right, as often the best films are. I thought I'd finished the film once, and then he came back and he said, "No, Rich, we need much, much more music." And off I went, and I wrote 35 minutes more music. As he said, it turned into a sort of an opera, so that every character, when they appear, they have a theme. So when Bill Sykes walks into the room and he kicks the door open, in comes his theme and plays with him for the first 2 minutes that you see him. And it was terrific fun to do that. It was so wonderful to have the music be a character like that in the film.
And does a director like Roman Polanski or other directors come with specific ideas like, oh, this should be Rachmaninoff-ish, or this should be Debussy-ish, or this should be Stravinsky-like?
Well, he didn't do that. He's very respectful of composers, and he would always say to me, "No, you write your music." And when I was talking to him about orchestration, he said, "It's fine. I understand what you're going to do. I'll leave it up to you." It can be very difficult if a composer is told by their director, "Oh, well, the cello is my favorite instrument, and it would be wonderful if you use that here," because it may not speak to the composer, or actually be appropriate for the scene. And often, I think it's a nervousness on the part of directors, I'm not including Roman in this, of not understanding this strange language that you put to films. And it's an area of the film they can't control or, direct in a way. And so they sort of latch onto pieces of music that they know or like, and it may not serve their film in the best way. It's also very off-putting if you're told to, write something in the style of somebody else, because that takes away the fun and the interest for me to create something new.
Are there contemporary clichés in movie music that you particularly despise?
Such as?
Well, I'm leaving that choice up to you.
Clichés. Oh, I don't know. I do find that there's far too much music in films now, and it's sort of sad and depressing the way that I feel that there's this fear of leaving scenes without music. And the beauty of using music in film is the silence when there isn't music, because if it's too much, it just becomes too soapy, and just you can't form your own opinions, because you've got something subtly helping you form an opinion in a scene.
Are there film scores that you particularly admire and look to as sort of the gold standard?
Yeah, I think Nina Rota's score for The Godfather was really stupendous and really wonderful.
Why is
that? Morricone's a wonderful composer. Why do I love
I love the use of themes. I love the fact that the music is a character and that it creates this world, plus the fact that it's just terrific music. And, you know, I mean, that is music that can stand on its own. It's not background music at all, really, even though it has been used for background. And, well, it's not always background at all, actually, because it's used quite sort of in a quite an operatic way. But it's just the music's so good, I guess.
How did you get into this? You must have started as a composer, not thinking you were going necessarily to be a movie composer.
Yeah, I did. I started writing pieces when I was about 14, 15, and I went to a very good school when I was 15 for a couple of years till I went to university, where I had a composition teacher, so I wrote a lot more there. And it was really when I was at university that I discovered that, well, I went to Oxford University, and they were very against people writing tuneful music or music that was... You know, tonal even. We were being sort of urged to sort of follow Webern, and there was no room for anybody doing anything different. So, I think I realized that I wanted to tell stories in music sometime around that when I was sort of 21, 22, and that's what turned me into looking to do film and television, because that's what I'm best at doing, and if I'm writing music, is describing something, telling a story. For me, it's all about the emotion.
The film composer Rachel Portman is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Another key aspect of the background in movies and television is the set design. Whether it's a fake police precinct, New York apartment, or a news magazine backdrop, designers want to create a set that looks good, but that for the most part stays in the background. But now high-definition television is on the scene, and as Dave Johns discovered, the super-sharp resolution of the new technology is making set design more of a challenge.
An estimated 16 million Americans currently own high-def TVs, a relatively small percentage of the total number of tubes out there. But the networks are now rushing to gear up old shows for the new format.
We're transformed now to the high-definition TV, and it's unbelievable. If you have a high-def television, the quality of the picture is crystal clear, and the clarity is just amazing. And last night, as a matter of fact, my young son was watching the show, and he looked up at the screen, and he said, "Grandpa, old."
And it's not just the stars who may start showing their warts and wrinkles. Shabby old sets readily reveal their flaws when shot in high definition.
The dinged up part doesn't fly so well anymore, whereas before you could hide it.
Ellen Waggett designed sets for ABC's Friday night sitcom Hope and Faith, and she's worked in front of high definition cameras for several years.
The hair or lint or that kind of stuff on a reflective surface will really show up. Things like dirt on glass has to be done really, really perfectly, or else it looks really, 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 really bad.
In addition to the focus on detail, the HD camera is also making set designers build broader sets to accommodate its wider field of vision.
You see a lot more scenery than you used to. All of a sudden you have all this other landscape around the talent, which is great for the set designer. We're always trying to show off our work.
Jim Fenhagen has designed HD-ready sets for Meet the Press, Inside Edition, ESPN Sports Center, and many other shows. High def has forced him to abandon age-old set design tricks, such as slathering brown paint on the studio floor to mock up real hardwood, something he did for NBC's Dateline years ago.
I'm not doing a lot of faux painting. In high definition, pretty much that's out.
Besides the new aspect ratio, designers have had to learn to deal with HD's tendency to flatten the depth of field.
Things that you were used to having sit in the background and sort of maybe get a little soft or a little fuzzy and sit down and behave themselves have a tendency to pop out at you.
Bob Shaw designed sets for The Sopranos, a show that shoots on film and then digitally transfers the pictures to high definition for broadcast on HBO. He now has to be especially careful about what products appear in the set background.
The logos and things become so prominent that people, you know, accuse us or assume that we're collecting money to place things on the show. And actually, I've had the producer on the set when we were doing something this year, and she said, "I really don't want to look this much like an advertisement." You particularly have to be careful when objects might be, you know, used for nefarious purposes, I don't know what you want to say, on a show like this, you know.
These flat screens, I'll tell you, no glare, high definition. I was watching on the waterfront downstairs. Tom Walden's nose hairs look like f***ing BX cables.
The keen eye of high def enforces a level of worry over the small stuff that may in the end create better art. Robert Thompson, professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse, says the richness of set design on shows like The Sopranos and Six Feet Under, viewed on high def's widescreen, is sure to make the life of the couch potato more cinematic.
Television now has to pay attention to what's on the screen behind and around the action in a way that they never did before. Now, what's happening is slowly the aesthetics of movies and the aesthetics of television are moving more towards each other.
But while what's going on in the background of the television screen may be growing more important, Thompson says the prominence of the television set itself may actually be in decline. He notes that since many thin-screen TVs can be hung on a wall like a moving painting, the high-def boob tube tends to recede somewhat into the background of your living room. For Studio 360, I'm Dave Johns.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is the film composer Rachel Portman. In a minute, Signorina Mona Lisa takes a coffee break.
You know, just as if she had stepped out of the frame for 5 minutes or so, and that was the title of the painting, Be Back in 5 Minutes.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you by The Economist, presenting this week Technology Quarterly with articles on alternative energy, predictive warfare, connectivity, and much more on newsstands and online at economist.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest is the film composer Rachel Portman. And today we are pulling back the curtains on the usually invisible techniques that artists use sometimes, the techniques that make a scene or character or a tune more powerful. One such technique in music is the bass line, those low notes that anchor everything and make the melody sound so sweet. In jazz and in popular music, the bass often jumps into the spotlight, putting the bass player in a really unique role. To help us understand how that works, we turn to Bill Lay of Bass Player Magazine and Victor Wooten, a virtuoso of the bass guitar.
I'm the youngest of five brothers. And so when I was about 2 years old, Reggie, my oldest brother who plays guitar, started teaching me how to play the bass. And it was a means for me to fit in with my brothers. It allowed me to do what they were doing, but I had my own role.
The bass players are people who are really interested in seeing the whole thing come together.
Standing in the background almost unnoticed.
Looking at the whole picture and how they can enhance it.
It's like the foundation of the band, that bridge between the rhythm and the harmony. The bass player defines the chord. Whatever chord is being played is defined by the root of that chord. And that's what the bass player is usually playing.
Play any chord. And if you choose different notes in the bass, it's going to change the context of the chord.
That means the chord changes. In other words, all the other notes can be changed just by the bass player changing his one note. So it's a very powerful position for the bass player, but it also adds to the responsibility that we have.
Bass players often especially focus on rhythmic feel.
The rhythm side of the bass is related to the drums. We are like the mother and the father of a family, the bass and the drums. We have to work together. We have to play off of each other. We have to listen to each other. The bass player is usually listening very closely to the kick drum in order to match what the kick drum is doing or to slightly play off of it. That's what's going to drive the music forward.
There's plenty of examples of the bass coming out front. And if you want to talk about how bass players can sort of straddle the line between being the background instrument and being the out front instrument, Larry Graham from Sly and the Family Stone is an excellent case. Because if you think of a song like Everyday People, where Larry Graham is just playing that one note over and over again, that bump, 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 over and over again, that's kind of the ultimate background thing. People probably don't even really think of what he's doing there. They think of the piano part, they think of the horn parts, they think of the singers. But it really wouldn't be what it was without Larry just playing that one note over and over again. Boom, 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 boom. But then at the same time, you get a song like Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself. You know, and he is playing this amazing, hitting the bass with his thumb and that is just revolutionary and really out front.
Larry Graham was the first person known to use his thumb on the bass.
He started, he was playing gigs with his mom when he was really young, and, you know, they didn't have a drummer, and so he started to develop this technique.
He started imitating the sounds of the drums by thumbing it with his thumb to create the bass drum, the kick drum sound, and plucking, snapping the string with his finger to create the snare drum. And he really brought the rhythmic side of the bass guitar to the forefront, making the bass guitar able to sound like a drum by thumbing and plucking the strings.
You know, and he revolutionized it. Everybody has been doing that ever since.
We were trying to imitate the sound Larry Graham was getting on the bass. And then along comes a guy named Jaco Pastorius, who teaches us about a whole nother part of the bass guitar that we were previously unaware of, and that was the use of harmonics. I remember a friend of mine played something for me that I thought was a piano player. And he told me it was a bass player named Jaco Pastorius, and he was playing this song called Portrait of Tracy. I thought it was bells or piano. And when I found out it was a bass guitar, I did what I always do. I did it with Larry Graham. Basically, I took that recording and I stayed up all night, literally all night, till the sun came up. I stayed up until I learned that song.
Most people who choose to play bass are quite content being in the background. You know, at the same time, if you spend your life mastering a particular instrument, you want every now and then to really figure out how you can express yourself in a new way. The interesting thing about a player like Victor Wooten is that he is really quite content in both roles.
Most people would know me from being the bass player with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones.
But he was one of the first guys to do an all-bass solo record, A Show of Hands, from 96. No overdubs, it's just amazing compositions that he was able to do using all of these techniques and a very musical mind.
Any musician who is searching out music finally gets to the realization that the music comes from the musician, not the instrument. I really wanted to prove a point more to myself than anyone else, I wanted to show that the bass guitar is a complete instrument. It's not just an instrument that does one thing. Now, it may be designed to do that one thing, and we need to know how to do that one thing first. But it can do anything.
My name is Vic. I'm gonna do a little trick. I'm gonna play my bass without using a pick. Travel around the world and back again. I just taking my bass out for a spin, and you know what I'm saying.
Victor Wooten's latest album is called Soul Circus. We also heard from Bill Lay, the editor of Bass Player magazine. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson, today with the composer Rachel Portman. Rachel, what did you think of that?
He's a genius. It's incredible what you can do on a bass. I had no idea. Just really, really clever.
You use the bass, not necessarily the bass guitar, but like big double bass.
Yeah, I love using basses. I love it when I have a big enough budget on a film to have lots of them. I'm sort of like a row of eight of them. And I don't know, I used a lot in my score for Manchurian Candidate. I was wanting to create something that was viscerally really frightening. And I was looking at ways of how music could really terrify you. And I started experimenting with basses and cellos as well, with a whole sea of them.
So that was scary, Rachel.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. It was quite a departure for me writing scary music, and it was a really fun challenge to do it. Because I think I'm thought of as someone who writes pretty nice, you know, English music. And so it was great to be able to go wild and experiment like that.
Yeah, very not girly or Jane Austen-y at all.
No, not at all. Yeah, I'd like to do. I mean, you know, I'd love to have more chances, not to do the same, but to do. You know, I just love doing new things. So no, it was great.
What makes basses and that kind of sound? Do you think we take that as connoting nervousness or sinister stuff?
It's the context in which it's used as well. I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, if you have just a straight drone, which is a long, constant, very deep note, it's very ominous. If you add to that a few deep, deep drum strokes, it's even more ominous. And if you do, well, I mean, I think, if you then start bending that note and getting, you know, I was asking everybody, all the players, to detune slightly and then just to do slow quarter note glissando sort of glides up to and down from the notes so that everybody was doing their own thing, but often very, you know, sort of quite slow glides. And it ended up sounding like a sort of buzzing bee sort of. And it was like the foundation that you're standing on sort of begins to move. And I thought, well, that feels frightening. And I was just doing it by feel, really. It sounded frightening. So I don't know, that seemed to me even more frightening than just a low drone.
And you were sort of getting back to the atonality that you resisted as a girl, I guess.
I know. So it took a scary movie to push me there.
The Oscar-winning composer Rachel Portman is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our next story is about missing Da Vinci's, Velasquez's, and Vermeer's, but I'm not talking about art theft. It starts with Sophie Matisse, a New York artist who's been reproducing masterpieces by all sorts of great painters, reproductions in which she leaves out certain key elements. Studio 360's David Krasnow has found himself transfixed.
It's kind of a weird little picture. You're looking out from a balcony with a heavy stone balustrade close to you. Far below you is the landscape. It looks swampy and unwelcoming. There are steep, craggy hills in the middle, and to the right, there's a mesa covered with brush and trees. The sky over the whole thing is yellowish, and there's a twisty road stretching off into the distance. It reminds me of the covers of fantasy paperbacks, like the Lord of the Rings editions from the 60s. But there's something else naggingly familiar about it. Oh, yeah, it's the most famous picture in Western art.
I did the Mona Lisa in 97, and
I had seen a book of her, of the painting rather, and the way that everybody has done that painting, you know, has manipulated the image. And I just, at the end of the book, I just felt exhausted. I thought, my God, you know, what more could we do with the Mona Lisa except take her out? You know, just as if she had stepped out of the frame for, you know, 5 minutes or so. And that was the title of the painting, Be Back in 5 Minutes.
Back in 5 Minutes was the first of what Sophie Matisse calls missing people paintings. She's done more than 20 by now.
I liked Vermeer, so I did a couple of Vermeers. I did Ang, Velázquez, and it goes on. I mean,
the Velázquez she did is called Las Meninas. Her version takes out a princess and her whole retinue, servants, dwarves, a portrait painter, leaving just an empty hall.
But here, I think, it's still a convincing painting.
That's Arthur Danto. He's the art critic for The Nation.
It would be odd to imagine Velázquez painting it, an empty room like this, but it's got a feeling of desolation. That's a fairly haunting piece.
Sophie's paintings aren't all melancholy, though. She did Edward Hopper's Nighthawks, and without those people sitting glumly around the counter, the bright little diner actually looks more cheerful. And there's a Roy Lichtenstein comic book picture. There's nobody in it to throw the punch, so you've just got the word pow floating on a yellow canvas.
It was started all out as a joke initially. I mean, there was no deep thinking about what I was doing. I just needed to get to work, and I was very intimidated because of wanting to paint, yet having the name that I do, it's not always a comfortable position to be in, because there's always a comparison thing going on.
In case you were wondering, Sophie is the great-granddaughter of the other Matisse.
Copying paintings or making replicas of paintings coming from the Matisse family was entirely the wrong thing to do. I mean, nobody from the Matisse family makes, you know, copies of anything. It's about originality. So in some ways it was a very freeing thing, because after that it just seemed like a door was opened.
So to avoid being compared to her famous relative, she invites comparison to other people.
It's like name the artist, but, you know, you don't always get Matisse. You usually get a whole bunch of other people first.
It's amazing that Sophie can imitate the styles of so many artists so well. And she's willing to take the risk that someone might see her pictures as gimmicky or as a defacement of great works of art. But Arthur Danto sees a lot more going on.
She's one of the few people who can play that kind of game. What would it be like if that weren't there? What would happen? I mean, if I were a teacher, an art teacher, I guess I might say, well, why is that there? Suppose you took that away. Or I asked the artist to justify it or the student to justify it. Well, here she's got the great masters to justify why it's there.
Even Danto's a little puzzled by Sophie, though.
We learn a lot about art, a lot about the art of painting from Sophie Matisse, but what her intention was, I can't really say.
I don't really think a lot about it beforehand. I mean, they all seem to be able to float in some ways, you know, without even that major figure in the middle. So I was always surprised at how the background was able to still stand strongly and the composition still stands strongly even after taking out the main subject of the painting.
I asked Danto if he thought any of Sophie's paintings were better than their originals.
Better than the originals? No. I don't think so. No. They're all fascinating. I mean, look at the Matisse over here, the conversation. Looks like they've gone to bed in that kind of way. They've gone, and that's the room afterward. All the tension has been drained out of that room, I guess.
In Henri's version of the conversation, there's a woman in black sitting in a chair and a man in striped pajamas standing across from her. There's a little window with a tree between them. Sophie's version is all gorgeous, deep blue wall. It's almost an abstract color field painting, except for the window. And I've realized that I like Sophie's better. The other one makes me uneasy.
Well, they're very uncomfortable. I mean, you're not the only one. Just ask anybody in my family how they feel about the... Yeah, it was a very tough conversation, I think.
First of all, look at how she is in her chair, and she's really stiff, and she's got a back that's as straight as a board. It just doesn't look like an easy conversation, so to speak.
So maybe I just can't deal with portraiture. Or maybe there's another reason why I like Sophie Matisse's paintings so much. She and I both live in a very noisy, crowded place with people in our faces from dawn to dusk.
Taking out all those people and you're left with a room, it becomes a space that you just sense. It has light coming into it and it has texture on the floor. But it's that emptiness, is the room empty if nobody's in there? It's like sometimes there's so much pleasure when there's just silence or just space is a wonderful thing that sometimes people don't appreciate as much.
For Studio 360, I'm David Krasnow.
Owen Agnew co-produced our story, and you can see images of Sophie Matisse's work at our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. The film composer Rachel Portman is my guest today, and we're talking about various kinds and forms and flavors of background. Rachel, have you seen some of those pictures?
I've seen reproductions of them. I think they're really wonderful, actually. They're very thought-provoking and funny and witty, and I agree that there's a sense of calm once a main subject has been taken away sometimes. You know, that's sort of wonderful. It makes you think.
It does make one think, and it makes me think also of the great trend these days of symphony orchestras playing the soundtracks, the scores from popular movies, and people in record stores are really into film soundtracks these days. Does that surprise you that people buy CDs of your scores, of soundtracks, and play them at home?
Well, no, not really. Not anymore, because people watch films so many times now. You know, films become part of their mm-hmm. lives in a way that never used to happen. And I also think that, you know, film music can satisfy a need for people who want to listen to classical music sometimes, or symphonic music, mm-hmm. when symphonic music that's being written by classical composers now can be so difficult to listen to. There's new music coming out that is very accessible, and I think that's a part of why people listen to it too.
Well, and it's interesting at the popular music level too, that ambient music and electronica and all that, I think, again, softens up the ground and blurs the dividing line between, well, what is foreground music? What is background music? And those distinctions become less obvious or important, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think that young people do have a sort of a background music to their life in a way that I don't know whether I did when I was growing up. I mean, there were songs that you remembered from, you know, this summer when you were 17 and what you did, and you associate them with that time. But it seems to me that people just sort of accompany their lives. You see them walking down the street and they've got music going sort of straight into their ears. In a way that I would find personally incredibly difficult, because I like silence and I like real sounds, and not to have, you know, something accompanying my life.
Speaking of silence, when you were researching the sound for your opera that you've written based on The Little Prince, you went to sort of extremes to research the nature of the silence you were trying to simulate.
That's right. I went on a trip on a camel with a friend, on another camel, and one guide with another camel, which was carrying all our water. The three of us went into the desert in Morocco for about 5 days. And because I wanted to hear what the desert sounded like. I needed to hear what that emptiness and that what the wind would sound like, what all that space would sound like, so that I could write it, because I needed to write it in The Little Prince, because that's where so much of it takes place, in the desert, without having been there. It was a really wonderful experience, and it was a floating kind of calm unlike any other that I experienced. And it was made all the more wonderful by having to travel there on a very, very uncomfortable camel, feeling far too hot.
And did it...
For all these things.
Did you write music and the score differently than you would have had you not gone to the desert for 5 days?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, there are bits that I can hear in the score of The Little Prince. There are bits that I wrote that where I'm thinking of that desert and what it was like. And it, for me, I'm writing what I heard.
Well, Rachel Portman, thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
You can hear Rachel's latest score in Roman Polanski's new version of Oliver Twist, which opens on September 30th. And her version of The Little Prince, which you're hearing right now, will be performed by the New York City Opera in November. You can find out more at studio360.org. Coming up, the singing songwriting charms of Amy Mann.
Sitting in your father's basement.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Pajamas, baby. She made up some excuse to see you. You said you didn't feel a thing. Tired of all the drama.
Studio 360 is brought to you by The Economist, presenting this week Technology Quarterly with articles on alternative energy, predictive warfare, connectivity, and much more on newsstands and online at economist.com. And by Lincoln Center, presenting Lang Lang, performing Chopin's first piano concerto with the New York Philharmonic under music director Lauren Mazel on Live from Lincoln Center, sponsored by MetLife, airing September 22nd on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine by the writer Jack Hitt. It was about white people trying somewhat desperately to claim Native American ancestry. Like a lot of newspaper or magazine articles, it was illustrated not with photographs, but with original paintings, in this case by a guy named Jason Holley. Holley is a successful editorial illustrator, a kind of hybrid of artist and commentator. An illustrator's job is to distill a writer's or editor's concept visually. Dennis Nishi followed Jason Holley as he worked on that New York Times Magazine article. In today's How Art Works segment, we'll find out how editorial illustration happens, what it's like to paint nonfiction on deadline.
Jason's been an illustrator for 12 years and has never had problems finding work. His A-list clients include The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and Esquire. He's currently working on 3 illustrations for the American Heritage and a full-page opener for the New York Times Magazine. The latter is due early next week. It's Thursday afternoon.
Hello.
Kathy.
Hi.
I got the article last night, and I think it looks great.
Kathy is a senior designer at the New York Times. It's her job to commission artwork and lay out the magazine. She's worked with Jason before.
It's a great story. It's got lots of layers to play with in terms of cultural identity, genetic identity. And the language issue is very interesting, too.
Jason sketches on Post-it notes while he talks. Later, he'll stick them onto a single page, which makes them easy to fax. The most obvious and simplistic ideas are put on top. He uses them as a guide for what not to do.
Did you or did somebody over there have a point of departure for this visually? I mean, are there things being kicked around, or do you want me just to kind of...
I sort of saw a single person, probably white or black, someone who does not look ethnically Native American.
Jason draws a white Indian with a sweater over his shoulder and a feather. He follows it up with a rearing horse with a Caucasian rider that has been cut out of the image and a bleeding hand holding an ID card. His favorite, however, is one he calls Mayonnaise a Copia, which depicts a cornucopia being poured out of a jar of mayonnaise. The design staff are amused, but they shoot it down for being potentially offensive.
Now you can't make fun of white people. So we were the last ethnic group you could actually make fun of. Which I don't know. I mean, I like mayonnaise. I'm not insulted by mayonnaise. And more importantly, the mayonnaise was part of the story. It was just used as an example of blandness.
The rearing horse sketch is approved by Kathy and the art director by the end of the day. It's Sunday evening, and Jason's behind schedule.
I drew and redrew this guy. I felt I was happy with him. And I've taken that drawing, and I've transferred it onto this board. And I'm just starting in on the painting.
Jason's style is reminiscent of naive folk art. He paints the horse in Plain's background using acrylics and drags a steel ruler across the surface to give it an aged look. He's mostly satisfied with the composition, though something about the color bugs him. Jason's wife, Lisa, provides some clarity the next morning and tells him it looks like a circus. He fumes for a moment before throwing the painting across the room. "She never lies," he says quietly. The painting is done by Tuesday afternoon. He scrounges around the studio looking for packing material and eventually makes it to FedEx.
I ended up going with a kind of a stereotypical caricature of Indian culture. This kind of roadside trading post, beaded belt kitsch, but kind of arranged in this sort of more somber way on the horse. And it's a layer that I don't know if anybody's going to really get. Just one way that, you know, my take on it or my sort of political leanings or whatever find their way into this piece and then ultimately onto the page.
Most importantly, everybody likes it.
I got the package. It looks totally fantastic.
Okay,
certainly
cool.
Addresses all of our concerns and... It just looks like your work. That's what we wanted.
The magazine's printed 2 weeks later, and I drop by with a copy. He looks at the cover apprehensively before opening it.
So here it is. It printed great. It looks really great. We ended up on the right side of the page, which is really nice.
Jason looks at his illustration and reads some of the article, which is now in context. Presented together, the work offers some additional meaning that he wasn't aware of when working on the piece.
It gives me this lonely and desperate feeling, which is kind of a sense I got from the article. I felt anxiety and this sort of displacement and just wanting to kind of find something that matters to you.
For Studio 360, I'm Dennis Nishi.
You can see Jason Holley's images from that article at studio360.org. The 1999 film Magnolia featured lots of big-name stars like Tom Cruise and Julianne Moore, but the director, Paul Thomas Anderson, structured his movie entirely around the music of Amy Mann, a relatively unknown singer-songwriter at the time.
It's not going to stop. It's not.
Magnolia got Amy Mann a lot of new fans, not to mention Grammy and Oscar nominations, but Studio 360's Eric Molinsky had been following her career since he was a kid. He had a chance to talk with Amy Mann when she visited our studio to perform some songs from her new album, The Forgotten Arm.
I was riding the bus back from junior high. A friend of mine offered me an extra ticket to see Amy Mann and her band Till Tuesday. Some of the other guys were going to U2 that night, but I was happy with my ticket. Till Tuesday was a local Boston band that had just hit it big with their single Voices Carry. I had never been to a concert before. I had just asked out a girl for the first time. It would be my only good day in eighth grade. When Amy Mann took the stage that night in 1985, she joked to the crowd, "So, you couldn't get tickets to U2? The joke turned out to be kind of prophetic. In the 90s, Amy signed on with big record companies, but they sometimes refused to release her albums. She was writing about ambivalence and hypocrisy on a personal scale,
not the kind of hit singles that bring in the junior high kids. Amy is now considered a hero among music independents. She put out 3 records on her own label, and her latest is called The Forgotten Arm. It's the story of a boxer who's addicted to heroin, and his girlfriend who's addicted to him. Here's the song, Going Through the Motions.
Okay, ready? Something isn't right. This record is strictly about drug addiction, but it just seems to be a metaphor for a lot of things for me. I mean, I see addictive behavior, I mean, in everybody I know, like nobody's free of it. I don't know, like it just seems like it's so universal that I'm sort of surprised when people, I guess people think of drug addicts as being like totally separate from most of society. But think again.
The album title, The Forgotten Arm, is a boxing term for the punch you don't see coming. Amy took up boxing before she wrote the songs. I asked her why she got such a rush out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I just found that sort of to be a really useful skill, you know, like in kind of realizing that, you know, the fear of getting punched was like so much greater than the reality. And it's exhausting. You can't really have a reaction based on the fact that you got punched. I mean, you can't get mad. You can't think like, oh, now I got to hit him. You know, it's like you gotta keep your strategy, you know, and keep your eyes open. And I do like to apply that in life, too. It's like, you know, keep your eyes on the ball. If somebody steals your parking place, like, is your goal of the day really to, like, get out and kick that guy's ass, you know, because he's, yeah. You know, or somebody honked at you? Like, is your goal to, like, get upset and have it ruin your day? Or, you know, or were you planning on doing some other things?
In She Really Wants You, Amy takes on a familiar role, talking to her main character as if she were the only friend who could level with him.
Sitting in your father's basement, waiting for the phone to ring. Still in your pajamas, baby. She made up some excuse to see you. You said you didn't feel a thing. Tired of all the dramas, maybe. But still, the moment you hear, the moment you
You often write from the point of view of men,
mm-hmm.
And really well, too, I'd say, as a man.
Thank you.
Have you always found that to be not too difficult?
Well, I don't. I mean, it also, I don't know, like when I was a kid, I got told like 50 million different ways that boys and girls were different and they thought differently and I wasn't allowed to do like anything fun was apparently the province of guys. You know, like, I couldn't have the black leather jacket. No, I couldn't get a motorcycle. No, I couldn't go surfing. You know, like, yeah. No, I couldn't play the bass guitar. Like, no. Yeah. Like, no, I couldn't play football. Like, everything I wanted to do was the province of guys. And along with that was this weird logic of girls don't do that because girls don't want to do that. And you're like, but I do. So it's like, and so I think it just really made me distrust, you know, the idea that men and women somehow think differently. I mean, I think there are a lot of struggles that are common to both. And I've certainly witnessed them. And I guess the short answer is like, no, it isn't difficult because you do have to assume that people are humans first.
It's not like I made a declaration at the age of 14 to become a lifelong Amy Mann fan. I just kept buying her records. Her double-edged lyrics fit really comfortably in my head. And when I finish listening to one of her albums, I feel like I can see how tough life can be. But I know I'll be able to handle myself.
You know, I mean, there's this sort of perception that my lyrics are really depressing, but like I often hear that the music is kind of, is like more cheerful or more uplifting. And to some people that seems like it doesn't make sense. But it all comes at the same time. Like to me, that's what the music says. And I think music is so interesting because it completely creates this emotional subtext that's ready-made, and then you have the story on top of it. And the fact that they may be about things that people think are kind of depressing, it's just the act of having a song about it, just talking about it at all, to me is very uplifting.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
Good. Thumbs up from management?
I think so.
You can hear some more of our interview with Amy Mann, as well as the song she performed in their entirety, on our website, studio360.org. Finally this week, we have a favor to ask. We just heard about how a great artist can provide inspiration throughout one's life, but is there some novelist or musician or film director, any artist you cared about deeply who really let you down? You look forward to everything they did, and then they went and dashed all your hopes. If so, send us an email through our website, studio360.org, and we'll be in touch. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Sarah Lilly,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Will Beckton.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support is provided by Lincoln Center, presenting Lang Lang, performing Chopin's first piano concerto with the New York Philharmonic under music director Lauren Mazel, on Live from Lincoln Center, sponsored by MetLife, airing September 22nd on PBS.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, refusing to turn the other cheek.
And Mingus, he wanted to actually beat Eric up because Eric was going to quit. Mingus threatened him. He wanted to fight him. He wanted to cut him with a knife.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Revenge, from children's books to Charles Mingus, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.